From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
On this week's show, flashing traffic signals are a sign of what's to come at some intersections.
If we think we've heard a storm of protest about 37 signals, just wait till we start talking about almost 200.
Plus, as Sporting KC looks to end the regular season with a sealed spot in the playoffs, hear from the team's leading goal scorer about his life journey.
After every time you hear gunshots during the nighttime, you wake up in the morning, you're just like, okay, how many bodies are you going to see laying down outside?
And jazz singer Deborah Brown talks about her new CD and international audience.
And each time I make a record, the scatting sounds a little bit different. I feel a little bit different, a little easier each time I make a record.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
As the campaign season kicks into high gear, KCUR brings you AdWatch, a series examining the accuracy of political ads on local airwaves. The Missouri Senate race has produced some of the season's most memorable and controversial commercials. KCUR's Brian Ellison checks them out.
Brutal, stark, totally devastating. Those are some of the ways national press outlets describe the three ads released by Senator Claire McCaskill's campaign last week. Each of the Democrats' ads, part of her tight race with Republican Congressman Todd Akin, features a woman speaking directly to the camera, saying things like this.
I'm a Republican and a pro-life mother and a rape survivor.
The three women in the ads are identified by their first names. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported last week that it, quote, has verified the basics of their stories. Still, there's no way to confirm their party affiliation or their pro-life views. Each ad centers on a central claim, as stated here by Diana.
In the hospital, I was offered emergency contraception. Because of my personal beliefs, I declined.
Emergency contraception seems to refer to the so-called morning after pill. It's typically offered to rape survivors, but it's available to anyone. So is it true that Todd Akin would criminalize it? Akin has said consistently that he thinks the pill is a form of abortion which should be banned. But criminalized, suggesting prosecution or punishment, doesn't seem to be a word he has used. McCaskill isn't even in these ads, but she's all over the ads Todd Akin released about the same time.
It's a corrupt Washington game, and Claire McCaskill plays it, getting rich off government. McCaskill cut funding for education and veterans, but partnerships...
The ad doesn't say, but the education and veterans programs in question seem to be those that the Akin campaign website points to, a 2009 interview where McCaskill tells KMBC that she thought certain programs should be funded not through the stimulus package, but through regular budget appropriations. The senator generally hasn't emphasized cutting those programs. In contrast, Akin's campaign website says he would support eliminating the whole Department of Education. And how about the $1 million claim? Well, it's misleading at best. McCaskill's husband, Joseph Shepard, does own a very small share in five companies that receive stimulus spending. His portion, though, of the $1 million or so they received would be in the neighborhood of about $26,000. And these recipients were determined by the Housing Department, not by the Senate. But the Akin ad's toughest words are yet to come.
Now a new scandal. McCaskill's family pocketed $40 million in federal subsidies. $40 million of our money.
Now, this claim does have fine print on the screen. It cites an AP article from last week. But looking at that article shows it isn't so simple. Shepard's investments are again the issue. He's part owner of more than 300 housing developments, and as many as a third of those did receive federal funds, totaling about $39 million. But there's no suggestion in that article that Shepard or McCaskill personally received those funds, nor that the senator did anything to guide the funds to her husband's businesses. Shepard made money on the property, to be sure, but the AP says it was between $500,000 and $2.5 million, and much of it might have come from regular rental properties, not the subsidies. If that's all too complicated, the end of the ad wants to make it simple.
Corrupt Claire. The moment her hand came off the Bible, it went into our pockets.
And if Akin's explanations of his own comments about rape and contraception have left any ambiguity in voters' minds, McCaskill's ads want to simplify that, too.
As a woman of faith, I must forgive Todd Akin. But as a voter, it's not something I can forget.
Missouri voters will show what they're willing to forgive or forget on November 6th. Brian Ellison, KCUR News.
To see the full video of the ads and KCUR's complete election coverage, visit kcur.org and click on Elections 2012. Drivers and pedestrians may have noticed some recent changes on the roadways. At 37 intersections across the metro, traffic lights are flashing red and yellow, and they're not broken. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan has the story.
You learn this stuff pretty early on. Green is go, yellow slow down, red stop. So when nearly three dozen traffic signals in the metro changed to flashing red or yellow lights, a lot of people didn't know what to think.
This is Mike Duffelson. I live in Maine and Meyer.
When you first noticed the change in the lights, what was your initial reaction?
I thought they were broken.
Mike has lived at the corner of this intersection for the past 10 years and has seen a lot of accidents here. He now knows that the lights are not broken and that this is a sign of what's to come. Stop signs will be replacing the flashing lights at these intersections, and this is just the beginning.
It's really hard to pull out of my driveway now because it's just this constant stream of traffic versus having a spurt and then a free space. Somebody was telling me they're having trouble walking their dogs across the street. But the city ought to save some money, which I think they're trying to do.
The city will save money, but Sean Demery of the Kansas City Public Works says that at the end of the day, that's not the reason for the change. It's about following federal traffic guidelines to maintain the city's traffic standards and to create safer roadways for drivers and pedestrians. But he and 311 have been really busy explaining those reasons to all of the concerned and confused citizens calling in. And there have been a lot.
We had a significant number of calls.
311 isn't the only place getting a lot of calls. Members of the city council were also busy on the phone, including Councilman Jermaine Reed of the 3rd District, which is home to 19 of the 37 lights in question.
My office has been inundated with phone calls as relates to this issue, and everywhere that I've gone in the community, people stopped me and asked me about the removal process.
So what is the process, and how is it decided which lights will stay or go? The city has been working on assessing traffic needs for the past decade. As populations change and people use other roads with more frequency, like, say, on Bruce R. Watkins, some lights no longer become necessary at certain intersections. The city conducts traffic counts that assess pedestrian and vehicular traffic and then use federal guidelines to determine if a signal is warranted.
A warrant is a set of conditions that justifies having a signal in a location. It's everything from volume over an 8-hour period to traffic volume over morning and evening peak hours, whether you're near a school crossing, what sort of accident experience we've had in that area.
Now, like I said before, this is just the beginning of a larger assessment of intersections in the metro. 350 additional intersections are being reviewed, and of those, 144 of them have already been determined to be unwarranted. Councilman John Sharp of the 6th District.
If we think we've heard a storm of protest about 37 signals, just wait till we start talking about almost 200.
Councilman Reed said that studies can only go so far.
There has to be that initial communication with residents, talking to them about the actual studies, but then also understanding from them their own interactions and understanding of the traffic signals in their particular area.
So Jermaine Reed and the rest of the council all agreed to pass a resolution to put the program on hold for 60 days until the city meets with residents to get more community input.
You have red, you have yellow, you have green, and the city staff used green in the beginning of this process, and we're at a point where we have to use the yellow, where we suspend and make sure that we are yielding and taking our time before we actually come to a complete stop, and making sure that the number one people who are affected by this, and that's the citizens of Kansas City, are communicated with.
While it's on hold, the city will conduct additional studies at the intersections in question. Sean Demery understands that communication is necessary, but still says the change is going to have to come and that it will actually benefit the community.
People put a lot of faith in those signals, and the idea that a stop sign may be safer than a signal is something that seems counterintuitive. But if you really take a look at it, it's a pretty straightforward thing. If you come to a signalized intersection, then assuming you are a top-notch driver, you have a 33% chance of being required to stop and yield the right of way. If you come to a stop sign, you have a 100% chance of being required to stop at that intersection and yield the right of way.
Which, Sean says, gives pedestrians more opportunities to cross and makes drivers more attentive. He also says that signs instead of lights have a positive environmental impact. These particular 37 lights are not only unwarranted, but are also some of the oldest lights in the city, like nearly 60 years old, making them not only clearly behind on current technologies, but also
a number of them are painted with lead-based paints.
Which covers one kind of surprising environmental impact, but there's more.
One of the downsides to signals that are not in warrant is that in many cases you've got vehicles idling at intersections where they don't need to. So you got additional vehicles burning additional fuel, creating potential pollutants.
The dialogue continues in the community, and lights continue to flash red and yellow. And a future of more and more four-way stops is potentially down the road. So I thought it might not be a bad time to review a basic driving rule. You've probably been there before, at a four-way stop. Somebody goes when they're not supposed to, another guy waves someone through out of sequence, nobody decides to go next, and then everybody decides to go all at once, and it can be really confusing and frustrating. Could you just quickly review what are the rules when four cars come to an intersection at the same time at a four-way stop?
Courtesy works well, but actually following the rules works even better. At an intersection, you proceed in the order that you arrived. If vehicles arrive at the same time, then you yield to the driver on your right.
For KCUR News, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
For a list of all the intersections affected by this change, go to our website at kcur.org.
Still to come, an area exhibit explores the meaning of American politics through images. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. There's been a lot of soccer buzz in the Kansas City area this week. The U.S. national team played and won the World Cup qualifying match at Livestrong Park, beating Guatemala 3-1 to advance on. And Sporting KC is about to wrap up the regular season this Wednesday with a first-place spot in the Eastern Conference for the MLS playoffs.
Sporting KC player Kai Kamara is the team's leading goal scorer and the subject of a new documentary based on his life called Kai. Kai grew up in war-torn Sierra Leone in West Africa and has traveled a long way through many obstacles to make it as a professional footballer. We're going to hear from an interview Central Standard host Jabulani LaFall did earlier this month with Kai about his journey.
We learn about some pretty harrowing things in the documentary. You're originally from Sierra Leone, the town of Kenema, which you fled during the brutal civil war there. Tell us about that experience growing up there. You're setting the scene with dead people all over the road with vultures picking at him, and it became desensitized after a while. Like, you didn't think about it. It was like second nature.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you grow up in a war-torn country, you know, like what we were going through. I mean, my mom left when I was six when she left, and you know, she came to the U.S. to find a way for me to join her and have a better life there. But you know, growing up in Kenema, you know, things were tough because when the war actually, you know, kicked off in Sierra Leone, the provinces were the ones and the villages were the ones that was, you know, really getting affected a lot. And yeah, day in and day out, it was just kind of just a regular day. Now, when you're going outside, you know, seeing dead bodies or just, you know, it was just part of your daily routine. After every time you hear gunshots during the nighttime, you wake up in the morning, you're just like, okay, how many bodies are you going to see laying down outside? But it was just, you know, having a family, like my family really kept me and kept a lot of us just away from trouble. And that was just the best way. Our family stuck together. And today, you know, we're able to just sit back and just talk about, you know, what happened back then and really, you know, just having those memories, you know, it made me the person I am today. And it's definitely has made me stronger and make me, you know, more responsible person, you know, really take care of my family.
Speaking of Sierra Leone, you're still doing humanitarian work in your native country. Tell us a little bit about that and how the film is involved with furthering that cause.
This is something I've been part of, and I love it. Like I said, since I started first just working with kids, I mean, it might have been in college, just going to coaching camps and stuff like that. I felt like this is definitely going to be something that I'm going to enjoy doing later on. And now being partners with a program called Schools for Salon. Schools for Salon comes to Sierra Leone and they build schools and orphanage and places like this for, you know, just kids all over. And it's so nice to see people coming from another country. They don't want anything from you. They're coming to put something for, you know, to benefit your country. You know, so when I got in contact with the lady from Schools for Salon, Cindy, and she was just, I mean, first I was like, okay, I don't know what to do. You know, you building schools. I don't have money to build schools in my country or anything like that. And she just walked me through it and saying, you know, it's not you. The people that love you are the people that's going to help you build these schools. And I was like, wow. And so obviously now then with the, when they connect me with the Cooper Putt guys to make the documentary, and after the documentary was done, that was when they decided that, well, you know what? The day when we premiere a documentary, it will be the information that you give to these people in your mission and what you want to do. And obviously for me, after visiting a lot of schools, when I do go back home in Sierra Leone, they're crowded. Or just some schools, kids are walking maybe like 2-3 miles to go to school because not everybody can pay transportation. So to have, you know, something in their local neighborhood, in their village, you know, instead of having like a school that's made out of zinc that cuts them up or anything like that, you know, $50,000 to raise that money, you know, to build a place for them that they'll be so happy because, I mean, the ones that they've built that I've seen, these kids were, the smiles on their face is saying, wow, we actually have a normal school here. It was priceless. You know, so for me to be part of this now, it's definitely something I want to do. And it's something that I would love, you know, to say I did this when I was in Kansas City, because this is where my career blossomed. This is where everybody showed me so much love. And I was able to, you know, put more smiles on the kids' faces, you know, in a little town, in a little village in Sierra Leone. And you really, it's not just going to be names saying it's Kai Kamara School, but it's going to be something about, you know, Kansas City. Maybe it's like, yeah, it's Kai Kamara, but most of the halls, it would be something that has something to do with Kansas City, because Kansas City is the place that gave me the opportunity to do this.
You first came to Kansas City. Speaking of you coming to Kansas City, you first came in 2009 after stints with the Columbus and San Jose in the Major League Soccer League. What are your thoughts on playing soccer here as opposed to those other places?
It's different. It's been the best place for me ever. You know, obviously, getting the kind of success that I have being here, you know, playing in the playoffs and everything. In Columbus was my first club, so I loved it. You know, obviously achieving what I've been working on, you know, saying I want to be a professional soccer player. So I'm in Columbus for 2 years, and, you know, the seasons wasn't as good, but it was fun. Just appreciating the fact that, you know, I've been blessed to, you know, do what I really wanted to do. And, you know, going to San Jose, it was kind of a short spell there. Soccer is big up north in California. You know, people really love it. Going to Houston was when I definitely started feeling like, okay, now I'm a professional soccer player. You know, I'm really doing what I'm supposed to do. Like, I'm going out and you know, meeting kids like hospital and stuff like this. And I'm like, wow, I'm really, you know, doing something good about this whole, you know, professional life. And then I get traded to Kansas City, and I'm like, what is Kansas City? You know? And, but like I said, since 2009, I don't know, I've never had a best like soccer career anywhere, even when I was playing club or anything like that, since I've been here. I mean, the stats can prove, because when I'm happy, obviously I perform a lot better. And now it's just, I mean, winning the U.S. Open Cup was great. And it makes you hungry for something more. And the whole city coming out to your stadium every day or every weekend to really support you, make you really, like, keeps you going.
You say in the documentary, you don't remember being good at soccer. Talk about that.
Not at all. I mean, growing up, man, I was tiny. I was a tiny kid. I was a tiny kid with a big belly. I didn't have a six pack that I have now. But so I never really was put on the field to play. You know, I was with teams all the time. I was around my brothers. I'll play when we go to school. You know, but because I was so small, nobody ever put me on the field. And, you know, after we fled and we went to the Gambia, you know, even there I was playing soccer, just playing with my friends in the neighborhood, and finally coming to the U.S. And then they were like, hey, make sure you play soccer out there when you go. And I was like, okay. I was like, I'm sure they're not going to pick me much, you know, because I'm not used to playing. And I finally came here, and in 2000 was when I, you know, we came in October. So I'm actually going to be 12 years by next month. So, and I finally got into the programs here. So I was 16 when I actually started playing organized soccer. And so I started playing. I went to high school, played there a little bit. This is in California now, and I'm playing in little club teams. And just going through these process, and I realized, I was like, well, I want to go to college. I'm living with my mom, who doesn't, you know, work just a minimum wage job. So she says she won't be able to pay for my college if I decide to go to college. And so I started finding ways on how to go to college, you know. And they were like, well, you can have scholarships, you know. I was like, well, I'm not the smartest kid. They were like, well, if you keep up the soccer that you're playing, you can do it that way. And so I did that, find out ways where I can get a scholarship through playing soccer. And I went to college, actually, knowing the fact that my mom didn't make that much money. I got financial aid to take care of my college instead of soccer. So when I went to college, I went to Cal State Dominguez Hills, where Los Angeles Galaxy players there, you know, it's their home field. And during that time, too, I started thinking, you know, if I keep pushing myself as hard as I'm going, maybe I can play professional. So it was basically just as the moment was going, I just kept pushing myself. And today, yeah, I'm sitting here in Kansas City.
What was it like to return triumphant to your home country? Skipping forward to that.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. In 2008 was the first time, you know, I got called up from a national team, like going back to play. You know, my brother had just passed away that year too, which I was really looking forward for him to see me play for once, because he's the biggest supporter of the whole family. Everybody.
And the better soccer player.
he was absolutely the worst one. My other one, who lives in Maryland, was the better soccer player out of the whole family. So, you know, yeah, just going back with the national team and just going back to Sierra Leone, you know, it was just tears of joy, just standing in front of the whole country and, you know, the full stadium playing against Nigeria, one of the biggest powerhouses. I'm playing, you know, in the same field with people like Nwankwo Kanu that you've watched your whole life. And, you know, it's just tears just, you know, kind of drip down my eyes during the national anthem. But it's just something that's just so great. And the Civil War, it's all over. And you're in a country where everybody's so happy now. So it was just, I mean, it's an honor every time I get a chance to go back.
Kai Kamara plays for Sporting KC and is the leading goal scorer. You can hear a longer version of this interview on our website at kcur.org.
Sporting KC's regular season finale is at Livestrong Sporting Park this Wednesday, October 24th. They'll be playing the Philadelphia Union. Sporting KC is in first place for the Eastern Conference, advancing to the MLS playoffs. This year's drought has damaged crops, but it hasn't hurt the price of farmland. In Iowa, prices are up almost 8% just since March. That's forcing a lot of small farmers to make some tough decisions, including Amish farmers in that state who are breaking tradition so they can afford to stay on the land. Harvest Public Media's Clay Masters has the story.
A long line of 18-wheelers idle at a big ethanol plant in Cedar Rapids. Scott Cole, who's in his 20s, hops into the cab of his truck after checking in at the plant. He farms 600 acres of corn and soybeans with his dad in Delaware County. He admits without the land and his family, he'd have a hard time being a farmer these days.
It'd be about impossible, I hate to say it.
That's because land values out here in farm country are skyrocketing. Last year, they jumped 32% in 1 year and are still on the rise, just at a slower pace today. That makes it tough for small and mid-sized farmers to expand. Cole's family farm is tiny compared to other farms in the area that have upwards of 20,000 acres. Now, a group of Amish have moved into Delaware County, and Cole says they're great neighbors, but a new form of competitor.
Like, those guys have more of an alliance with each together, I guess, so they can, you know, put their money together to buy ground, where, you know, a lot of us nowadays are individual farmers, where it's tough to, for one person to put money together, I guess, to buy ground.
The Amish have become more progressive just to compete in the marketplace. They may use tractors or hire someone to drive them for construction work. This group of 20 Amish families moved here because of a bishop's rule at their former settlement that men can only work 2 days a week off the farm. One of them is John Henry Yoder. In addition to organic oats, corn, and alfalfa, Yoder sells organic eggs and goat's milk. To make ends meet, two of his 15 kids have a thriving construction business. Yoder says putting limits on what they can do for work just wasn't feasible.
The idea behind it was so more of the Amish or more of the folks stay on the farm. And that was a good idea. I think that's the place to raise your family. But as time goes on, things change, and not everybody sees it in that perspective.
To keep all of his family on the farm, he'd have to get bigger. And with the way he farms, he says he can't afford to pay the $6,000 to $8,000 it costs for an acre of land out here. So the Amish have to find other ways to thrive. Donald Krabel researches Amish life at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He says in the mid-20th century, over 90% of Amish households relied on agriculture for their primary income. But come the turn of the century, there were just too many babies and too few acres.
It would cost typically $2 million for an Amish couple to set up a farming operation with 50 or 60 acres. So all of those pressures pushed the Amish toward other occupational ventures.
The problems of the Amish are the problems of beginning farmers, are the problems of medium-sized farmers.
That's Mike Duffy, an agriculture economist at Iowa State University. He says as technology moves forward, you need less labor on the farm. And while Duffy doesn't think we'll see a farmland bubble burst, he says land values will slow down, more like a tire that's hit a nail. As for Amish farmer John Henry Yoder, he says he wants to expand his farm, but he's got bigger problems.
I think I should do more, you know, just having some family time. With high cost of living and a family to support, sometimes we get a little sidetracked by, thinking we got to just keep working and keep working.
A concern just about anybody can relate to, regardless of your lifestyle. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Clay Masters.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. What images best convey the meaning of politics in America? An exhibition at Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence explores this idea through photography, prints, paintings, and archival political ads, as well as a poodle skirt. KCUR's Laura Spencer met with Burdette Loomis, longtime professor of political science at the University of Kansas, who curated this exhibition, which is also his first.
I was looking over your resume, and you have so many papers and books and presentations, but I didn't see an exhibition curator listed.
No, this is my first as an exhibition curator, but over the course of time, probably over the last 30, 35, 40 years, my wife and I have collected a lot of art. We have a house full of art. I have an office full of overflow art up at KU. So I've been heavily involved in art. When I was on the board at Friends of Spencer, I talked to Sarah Lynn Reese Hardy a bit about maybe doing something over the course of the presidential election. And so that was probably a couple of years ago. And with the help of Selka Strawn, who's come on board to work with various university departments, we started thinking about what this exhibition might look like.
From a political science professor perspective, were you aware of bias, like wanting to include people from different political parties? Was that sort of a factor in decision making?
No. I think what the question was not to make it overtly political. Although, for example, we do have two big photos by Larry Schwarm, and one's a Democrat and one is a Republican. So there was a little bit of balance there. But mostly the show was selected to, in a time in which we're bombarded by images, to make people step back, put a little distance between themselves and politics, and maybe take a fresh view, even looking at images that we're familiar with, older images, but images that in some sense will jar us a little bit and make us reconsider the nature of politics.
Well, you talked about drawing from the Spencer's collection, but you also tapped into the archives of the Dole Institute, and you were the interim director for several years.
Right.
I wonder if you could talk about if there were some pieces that you had wanted to put on display in some way, and this kind of gave you an opportunity.
Yeah, and the Dole Institute's a great resource on the campus, and the archives in particular are probably underseen by many of the people in the community. And so being down in the bowels of the of the Dole Institute, I saw a cummerbund, this ornate beaded cummerbund that was given to Bob Dole, and I thought, I have to have that. And in a more familiar vein, I'm using one of his television commercials from 1974, this classic commercial called Mudslinger that really is well known beyond Kansas, beyond Bob Dole.
And Bob Dole has been the farmer's number one hired hand in Washington for 14 years, all of which makes Bob Dole look pretty good and Bill Roy look like just another mudslinger.
And so at some point does a commercial, and this is for Dole, but I also have a couple for Dennis Moore, at some point does a commercial stop being useful politically and somehow become a work of art.
I hope you'll be picking Dennis Moore for Congress. Thank you.
There are some interesting works, some as old from as the 1800s, right. But there's also a photograph from 1910.
The photograph of the young girl in the textile factory. A couple of things. First of all, it's not overtly political, although I think politics are right there. It's clearly a photograph of child labor. This very small girl with these looms behind her. And one of the themes of the show is repetition. We have Andy Warhol's green stamps, one after another after another. Politics is a repetition of messages. And so I thought that the photo, not only did it say something about politics, this young girl at the cusp of child labor legislation, for example, but it also said something about repetition in industry and how powerful the machines can be, and metaphorically how powerful the political machines might be. And I just think visually, the small girl with all these spools of yarn behind her was a really powerful visual image.
Well, I noticed that in the corner there's a ballot box, and are people voting on favorite works? Is that okay?
We have not disrupted the integrity of the voting process, so I don't know. I have not seen anyone stuffing the ballot box yet, but if things don't come out right, I'm in the last few days of the exhibit, I may grab a few ballots.
You're expecting low voter turnout?
I think low voter turnout is probably the order of the day, yes.
KU political science professor and exhibition curator Burdette Loomis spoke with KCUR's Laura Spencer. The exhibition Politics as Symbol, Symbol as Politics continues through January 27th at the Spencer Museum of Art at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. More information and images can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
Coming up, locally based singer Deborah Brown talks about her international career. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, new plans for a new airport were released, and three key Kansas City area businesses were about to see major ownership changes. KCUR's Steve Bell looks back on those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Japanese wireless carrier SoftBank says it'll pay $20 billion for a 70% interest in Sprint Nextel. CEO Dan Hesse said the deal will let Sprint pay down its debt, buy new network equipment, and make some acquisitions of its own.
And there could not be a better time for us to have this infusion of capital into the company during this investment phase.
Analysts agreed and said the sale will be good for Sprint and the Kansas City area. Sprint stock went up, SoftBank stock went down, and AT&T complained to regulators that if they allow the deal, SoftBank will control too much wireless spectrum. The following day, HCA announced it's negotiating to buy St. Joseph's and St. Mary's hospitals from their nonprofit owner. Blue Springs Mayor Carson Ross had some concerns about St. Mary's, which is only 5 miles from another HCA-owned facility.
We just want HCA to know what great support that hospital has in Blue Springs.
With the purchases, HCA would control more than 26% of area hospital admissions. The following day, CME Group, which owns the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, Chicago Board of Trade, and New York Mercantile Exchange, announced that it's buying the Kansas City Board of Trade for $126 million, Mark Davis of the Kansas City Star said it was all about hard red winter wheat.
The wheat that they grow in Kansas is the stuff that trades in Kansas City. And what we're seeing here is a great deal of interest in that product that Kansas City has and Chicago would like to own.
Some were concerned that CME would close the Kansas City Exchange, which began trading in 1856. The council didn't act on plans to tighten the rules and increase accountability for community improvement districts. Ed Ford is among those who want more limits on the areas that get permission from the city to raise their sales taxes and keep the money for improvements.
Let's say we have a neighborhood-based CID, and we don't have a time limit on it, and it does absolutely nothing that it said it was going to do.
But Ford also made it clear more discussion by his council committee is needed before they'll have a formal proposal for the full council. City Aviation Director Mark Van Lowe unveiled the latest plans for a new single-terminal KCI airport.
The actual terminal facility fits on top of the existing site of Terminal A. We have enough space in B and C to move everybody out of Terminal A while we're constructing. Airport operates as normal. No one hardly notices.
Total projected cost, $1.2 billion, to come from existing funds and the airlines. Expected completion date on the new KCI is 2016, maybe. This is KCUR.
Carl Orff's Carmina Burana is based on medieval poems about love, drinking, and spirituality, somebody and irreverent. For Kansas City Ballet's epic-scale production, music director Ramona Pansagraw conducts the Kansas City Symphony and leads a large chorus on stage and in balconies. KCUR's Julie Denechet stopped by a rehearsal and has this report.
Most of our listeners and viewers will relate to Carmina Burana through O Fortuna.
Carmina is incredibly approachable music-wise, but it's also very visceral. Those pounding rhythms are, it's one of a kind. My name is Ramona Pansagraw, and I'm the music director and principal conductor for Kansas City Ballet. I will have the symphony chorus stacked to the ceiling on both sides of the stage, as well as the ragazzi, the children's chorus from Liberty High School, as well as 24 singers on stage and the full symphony in the pit. So the sound should be extraordinary.
William Whiteness, artistic director, Kansas City Ballet. Well, Carmina Burana comes from the, depending what your sources are, 11th, 12th, 13th century texts and poems from students of the clergy. And they were satirical, irreverent, so it's a rather bawdy piece. And Carl Orff then, in 1936, took these poems and texts and put them to music.
My name is James Jordan. I'm ballet master for Kansas City Ballet. Carl Orff's score is really a powerful choice for a ballet because there's so many rhythms involved and the power of the voice and all the underlying layers of beats and percussion. There's so many choices for the choreographer to make.
Choreographers are very musical, and especially in the case of Tony Pimble. The tempo, for example, of one of the sections here is as fast as I've ever heard it, but it is Orff's original tempo marking. But no one ever tries it because the Latin is vicious at that tempo. She's got it that fast, and it is so exciting.
Tony Pimble has chosen to have 24 of the chorus members and the three soloists really interacting with the dancers on stage.
The singers on stage obviously have issues to deal with. They have to know where they are spatially on stage. They have directions they have to turn. They will have dancers running in and around them, as well as trying to sing.
The singers are really physically challenged, and they're trying to really just be like the dancers. And she wants them to all look like they're a part of this medieval community together, that they aren't just a group over there singing notes and a group over here dancing around, that it's this whole community. And I think she's really achieved that.
But what's really exciting to me is that we have probably the largest number of singers, dancers, and musicians in the Kauffman Center for one particular event, Carmina Burana. That is a remarkable use of talent in the Kansas City area.
The Kansas City Ballet presents Carmina Burana, choreographed by Tony Pimble, and two other works through Sunday at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. More information and a video can be found on our website, kcur.org. Click on Arts and Culture.
Kansas City-based singer Deborah Brown says her new CD, All Too Soon, explores the hidden gems of jazz songs. Like most of her music, the disc delivers a no-nonsense romantic sound to fans of classic swinging jazz.
For much of her career, the singer has found those classic jazz fans at nightclubs, concerts, and festivals in Europe. She's spent the last couple of decades living and teaching off and on in Europe, and she also performs regularly in Russia. Deborah Brown recently talked to Susan Wilson about her new CD and her enthusiastic international audience. Brown's career started by paying her dues in Kansas City, but the Midwest could only contain her for so long.
When I went to Europe in the mid-80s, then I really found my stride with the jazz music, working with people like Horace Parlin, who played with Charles Mingus for many years, Red Mitchell, who played with Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan, Ed Thigpen, who was the drummer for Ella Fitzgerald. I had a lot of stories and also a lot of good advice from those guys. And School of Hard Knocks, I would say. I feel like I'm part of the old legacy, and yet I was a young person coming into that, but I got a chance to really feel what it was like to play with those jazz masters, and that's an invaluable experience.
Any differences between the European audiences and the Kansas City audiences?
Well, of course, the Europeans are trained. They know, I mean, they've seen the best of that American jazz has to offer on a regular basis. It's state-supported, in a way, because all of their cultural programs have some state funds behind it. So it's not like, an individual is going bust because they have jazz concerts. So it gives you, and then also it's a part of their normal activities. Okay, we're going to go to see a jazz program. Their festivals are fantastic. So this is part of their culture. And to me, it's just amazing that I can sing the spoken word. I don't know if they understand the words, though many Europeans do speak at least three or four languages because they're landlocked with all their, with all their country and their language. So they have to learn other languages just to travel. So they're very tolerant in that they will give you the respect of listening to the words, and they understand what you're saying, or they feel what you're saying. And they respond appropriately.
Now, what's the response in Russia?
They're like Kansas City. If you sing a really good note, they'll clap for you really loud. I said they're like a black audience in Kansas City. I love it.
So what you're saying is kind of a tough audience.
Well, I mean, no. They will like, they will be in your corner 100%. And if you do something fantastic, but you have to do something fantastic now.
Right.
They will clap for you. It will be out of sequence. They're not proper audience clapping after the solos. they would clap in between. They'll clap whenever they feel like, wow, that was good. And they'll clap just right there. And a Kansas City audience does that too. But what they do is if you really do well and you hit a really nice note, the end of the song comes, what they do is bring flowers to the stage.
Oh, how nice.
So I have pictures after the concert of, you know, an entire grand piano filled with flowers. It's really very neat, unusual thing, and it does make you work harder.
So let's talk about your new CD, All Too Soon. I know this is a very difficult question for any artist, and I know artists hate this question, but what was your favorite song of this project or songs?
Actually, Indian Love Call, because, and I think the reason why is because so many people turned me down for making any, they would just look at me blank when they heard it. How am I supposed to turn something like that into a jazz tune? But my pianist, Rob Van Bavel, didn't blink an eyelash. And I thought that was, well, probably he did. I didn't see it. But he wrote the arrangement, and I thought, how interesting the way he heard that. When I'm calling you, will you answer too?
Watson, as you pointed out, is definitely on the CD, and I know he's a friend and a musical colleague. What was it like to work with him on this project?
Bobby is unpredictable. He's fun. He's deep. And the feeling that he gets, and whenever I mention his name anywhere that I work in the world, people always relate to him as, oh, that man with that feeling that he has in his music. There's a certain Kansas City feeling. They even tell me that there's a lilt in the way that he plays. He's an awesome musician.
And I noticed that his wife penned one of the songs, Like It Was Before. Tell me about that song.
Yeah, that was a deep song, and there was a lot behind that song, because that was one of the songs that I chose that in actuality didn't have any lyrics on it. And I thought, well, maybe I should write some lyrics, because I really enjoy reading that lyric and I really enjoy the intriguing title. But Pam had lost her brother, and this was one of the songs that came out of it. So this song is actually a song that was really penned because of the time that she didn't have with her brother. Mm-hmm. So it's a very personal song for her. And I embraced that and chose that, because we did two versions of that song, one with lyrics that I'd written and one with lyrics that she'd written. And I felt this was her song and this was what I needed to do. And so I put her lyrics on there.
Time is such a funny thing. It seems as if it is standing still. But the change is seldom seen, because moments are so swift, those changes turn into moments frayed.
You're listening to Casey Kearns. Today we're speaking with Deborah Brown about her new CD titled All Too Soon.
Every night you come and you find me.
So another song, Evening. I'm sorry, Evening. It has a strong bluesy feel. How do you get into the bluesy mood, and what kind of effect were you striving for in this song?
I think when you said evening, instead of evening.
You see, I had to get that together.
That's the start of it. Evening.
Evening.
Well, you know, I've really wanted to do that song for many years. I've always liked that tune. And I couldn't figure out how to... It never went on any other records that I made. But this was the record that it was made for. And when we got to the studio, I didn't tell the guys that they were going to do this. I just sprang it on them. Because I wanted it to be something that was not planned out. They just put that together in the studio, the little lines behind it. I think it came out great because it sounds so lively and fun. Even though I try, how can I go on? Take me evening.
Yes, and you are heard scatting on this project.
Not scatting, but scatting.
Scatting. Okay. I'm getting just a little bit too proper on the air.
No,
here.
Scatting. Scatting is a proper word. Let's get that straight. Scatting. Well, that's part of... You know, that's jazz. I like the book that Toni Morrison wrote called Jazz. It was a book, and when I bought it, I was excited about it because when I started reading it, I realized it was the same story told by all of the witnesses that had seen this one event. And I thought, that is just so perfect. So everybody has their way of telling the story. Mine, from my singing point of view, from the pianist point of view, bass, and so on.
So it really tells the story of jazz, because jazz is a story of improvisation and people coming from their own place.
That's right. And each time I make a record, the scatting sounds a little bit different, I would think. Scatting sounds a little bit different. I feel a little bit different. A little easier each time I make a record, and that way I'm communicating my story a little easier. Scatting is a challenge.
Yeah, I mean it does not sound easy. Let's put it that way.
It's so much fun.
Well, Deborah Brown, thank you for being with us on KC Currents today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so very much.
Deborah Brown's new CD is called All Too Soon. The singer says she's trying to do more performing stateside. She's appearing at Johnson County Community College's Winterlude Festival in mid-January. Well, we sincerely thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. We had help this week from Andrew Hansborough. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross, and Zach Lewandowski is our intern. Our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.